We pay a lot of attention to grand gardens, don't we? We hand over money to visit them, we watch TV shows about them, we love wandering around in those generous acres of green. But what about the small gardens, the modest plots where most of us spend our gardening time? Writer and journalist Margaret Simons has been a keen gardener since she was in her early 20s, and though she's had large gardens in the past, these days she's living in the inner burbs of Melbourne and working with just 6 square metres of soil. And 6 square metres is the name of her latest book. But it's about much more than gardening. It's also a memoir and a series of intimate reflections on life. Margaret, welcome to Blueprint for Living.
Thank you.
So it seems to me that gardening is so much more than just a way to grow food for you. Why do you think you've been such a devoted gardener for so long?
Well, it makes me happy is the short answer. My other life, if you like, is as a journalist, often publishing on contentious material, and as journalists tend to do, making people cross with me and so on. I also work as an academic, which can also be fairly high stress. And, you know, weeks at a time go by when I don't get into the garden, but when I do, I'm a better person. I come out much happier. And yes, 6 square metres plus a whole load of pots, which I sort of tend to try and squeeze in almost anywhere.
Which wasn't going to work for the title of the book, really, was it?
No, no, that's right. also a great deal of my backyard is very light deprived, so I've been conducting this long experiment about what will grow on minimal daylight. If you read all the books, they'll tell you need a minimum of 8 hours sunlight. Well, I'm here to tell you that parsley and silver beet can do with less.
They'll survive a nuclear holocaust.
That's right.
So tell me more about that happiness. What are the ingredients for you of that particular happiness that comes from working in your 6 square metres?
Well, I won't say my mind goes quiet, because unfortunately I think that very rarely happens. But I find myself entering into this sort of extended conversation with myself. I'll often start off thinking about a book I've read or a film I've seen or whatever as I'm sort of getting my fingers dirty and everything. And then it just turns into this, you know, constant sort of reflection and conversation with some part of myself, which I don't access very often. And as I say in the book, it occurs to me that this is what some people would call prayer. But coming from a strict atheist background, think of it as a conversation with my better self, I suppose. But I emerge from that refreshed and renewed. Also, there's something about the close examination and maybe having a small space. I've had very big gardens in my past, but having a very small space, I really do know every inch of it. I know the tomato that's looking a bit water deprived and the bok choy that's going to seed. And there's a sort of intimacy to that which I think is quite sensual, really.
So is that the main difference for you between having a large garden and a small gardening? The sort of, as you say, the intimacy, the knowing every square inch?
Yes, I think so, although I would have a larger one if I could. I would like to grow more. And in my past, I lived in the Blue Mountains when my children were little. They're now all about to fly the nest. I was nearly self-sufficient in vegetables and also kept chooks and goats and ducks and all sorts of other accidental wildlife. And I really did love that as well. But there was always that feeling that it was going to overwhelm you, particularly in spring or summer. You'd think, you know, if I don't get out there and prune, then it'll be a disaster. Whereas with a small garden, not too much can go wrong.
You mentioned that garden you had in the Blue Mountains, and you write about it in the book, and you nearly lost that garden, didn't you? What, tell us about that.
Yes, well, it was just a few weeks after my youngest child was born, my son. There was a massive bushfire in the Blue Mountains, which came right up to our boundary, and we had fire trucks parked on the ground, on the lawn. I was evacuated. It was the first trip I'd taken away from home since I was discharged from hospital from having my son. It was an extraordinarily frightening experience, and sadly one that's becoming so common, because within minutes it went from sort of smoke on the horizon to go, go, go with the flames in sight. People died that day. And when I came home, the nappies that were hung out on the line had char marks on them. And our little lawn and my vegetable garden was the only patch of green in a completely blackened landscape. And, of course, all the wildlife from the national park was on our lawn. One of my fondest memories is my daughter toddling out with bowls of water for the wildlife. And yes, we were a sort of Noah's Ark of the neighbourhood for a little while.
Your relationship with the plants that you grow is often a very close and a very intense one. It made me wonder if that comes in part from being a writer and a journalist, that you have to be a close observer of the world.
Well, I must admit that I find it hard to understand how anybody could be a writer without being a gardener, but I do recognise that that's just me. I mean, one of my rules for getting writing done is that you're not allowed to do anything else, so you set aside a period of time, and quite often, of course, it's a horrible time in which you're staring at the screen and nothing's happening, and the great temptation is to go and tidy your sock drawer or do any of the other things that seem infinitely attractive.
It's a procrastination.
Yes. Now, I hate weeding. And so the only thing I am allowed to do when I'm in one of those ghastly spaces is to weed, because writing remains more attractive than weeding. So when the idea comes or the writer's block departs or whatever, I will be back at the keyboard writing. And there's something about getting outside and doing a few little bits of something, which for me are completely bound up with the creative process.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, other people assure me that it's not this way for them, but I have trouble understanding that.
Yeah.
Keeping chooks as well, I think, is very good for writing.
So these are your little rewards. These are your little moments of going away and, yeah, as you say, reflecting on the process, or perhaps shutting out the writing process for a moment.
Yes, and also, I think it was George Bernard Shaw who said that there's nothing as unquestionably as useful as growing food. And a lot of the time, writing doesn't feel particularly useful. And so if you go out into the garden and, you know, and plant a few onions or something, you think, well, you know, doesn't matter that much, you know, but it'll be all right.
And you've done something truly useful, something
yes.
edible. I noticed that you tend to anthropomorphise your plants. You almost assign personality traits to them.
Mm.
You know, your plants can be sullen or sulky. Is that just the writer embellishing as she writes, or do you think of them as having some kind of personality?
Some of them, not all of them. Some of them remain strangers to me. And others I have quite an intense relationship with, like my mandarin tree, which I'm happy to say, with the coming of spring, I write about it very critically in the book, but it's actually covered in blossom at the moment, which I sort of think, did you know that you were in the book? Because in the book it features as the tree which will not give. And there are other plants which I don't really have a relationship with, but then there are others like, you know, the succulent by the wheelie bins and so on that are a constant presence in my life.
We learn a lot about your family life as we learn about the garden, you know, and the way different generations and parts of the family interact with, particularly with the food that you produce. How important for you has that role as a producer of food and not just a preparer been to your family life?
Oh, really important, particularly, as I say, when my children were little. We lived in the Blue Mountains up until they were about 5 or 6. They were both born up in the Blue Mountains. And that was fairly constant, and the children were constantly in the garden with me from a very young age. You know, I remember Claire as a toddler eating her first snail shell and all, and no garlic butter. Now, neither of my children are keen gardeners at the moment, but then I wasn't when I was their age. As you said, it happened within my early 20s that something clicked. But yes, you know, the bringing in of food, the kids wandering out and eating the peas before they get back to the kitchen, all those sorts of things are very much part of my family life. And, you know, I'm one of these people, as the book records, whose family life hasn't gone according to plan. I've been married twice, and I have 2 sets of stepchildren and my own children as well. And it's all an incredibly messy but rather wonderful family.
Well, you know, and that description could well be a description of how you see your garden, rather messy but wonderful too.
Yes.
And, you know, it reminds me that our language is so rich in gardening metaphors, isn't it? You know, we talk about reaping what you sow, we talk about wallflowers and bad seeds and getting rid of dead wood. Why do you think the language of horticulture has invaded the English language in this way?
Well, you know, there is something about the rhythm of the seasons which is absolutely fundamental, I think, archetypal. Almost every story arc in fiction, you know, you descend into the winter of the low point of your characters, and then there is spring and summer. We talk in garden metaphors all the time without straining at all. We talk about things going to seed and lying fallow and, coming of the spring and all that sort of thing. And I think there is something about our lives on this planet which is so bound up in the seasons and what happens with the turn of the seasons that there's no escaping from that, really. And gardening does put you in touch with that in a very direct sort of fashion, but I don't think you have to be a gardener to experience that. Try going for a whole day without using a gardening metaphor in ordinary conversation. It's very hard to do.
There you go, listeners. There's your task this weekend. It's interesting you mention winter because you know, those of us who are gardening in the south of Australia are just emerging from a very long and very cold winter, and we're hanging out for spring to arrive properly. Mm. But you write very positively about gardens in winter. Persuade me, Margaret, what's good about gardening in winter?
Given that, you know, you do have to understand I'm not a particularly good gardener. I'm an enthusiast rather than an expert. And so things are always going wrong. In winter, they go wrong more slowly.
Positive reframing of a negative, right?
Exactly. they don't overwhelm you. So the fact that you haven't got to some chore or task, and I'm always far too busy, doesn't become a disaster in the way it does in spring and summer when everything's going all over the place. So winter can be quite a forgiving season in that way. That's one of the things I like about it.
A lot of gardeners are probably feeling pretty anxious about the looming threat of climate change, and what it's potentially going to do to the seasons, which we're so used to, and to our beloved plants. Is this something you think about when you're gardening?
Yes, I do, because I notice the seasons coming with a different kind of rhythm, and obviously those extremely hot days in which, you know, the worms cook in the compost bin and it's very hard to keep anything alive, you know, those are genuinely frightening. I referred earlier to bushfires. The bushfires are getting worse, they're getting wilder, the seasons are shifting. And in the midst of that enormous happiness that gardening can give me, there is sometimes, you know, that sharp intake of breath, the fear that this is changing, that my children will have a harder life than I have had, my grandchildren even harder, and that we're not doing enough about this or soon enough.
Speaking of children, I can't let you go without telling us the story or the ritual of the Barbie doll leg and the compost.
Oh, yes. Well, the compost would end up containing all sorts of weird things, like, you know, the vegetable peeler you lost. But one continuing feature, along with bits of Lego and other bits and pieces, was the leg of the Barbie doll. And normally I would clear out the compost heap, take out all the good compost that I was going to use on the garden, sieve out all the bits and pieces. But the Barbie leg, I just liked having it in there.
And why?
So it kept on going in there. Well, it was something about, you know, Barbie. I mean, what a picture of womanhood and of life and all the rest of it.
So you're punishing Barbie by putting her leg endlessly in the compost.
I don't think of it as punishment. I think of it as a very rich experience. I don't find Barbie the doll life-affirming. Compost is the ultimate life-affirmer. I think I'm a huge fan of compost.
Margaret, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. Margaret Simons is the author of the memoir 6 Square Metres, published by Scribe, amongst many other books she's written, and she's also the director of the Centre for Advancing Journalism at Melbourne University. I'm Sian Pryor, and you're listening to Blueprint for Living on RN, Radio Australia, and online.